Hey, Nerd Funnelers, we're back. I'm Bob Shway. You're listening to Nerd Funnel, where we take all the nerd news of the world and funnel it into your more than willing ear holes. With me today is Juan.
How are you doing, buddy?
And we are getting into the Halloween season a little bit here, so we're going to be talking about scary games and movies and the nature of fear and how which movies kind of best play to that. Now, it's a huge topic to kind of consider, but we're going to take a kind of a our way in, and then we'll just kind of branch out and see where it leads us, is going to be like, you know, in our everyday lives as, you know, hashtag first world for most of us.
We actually have to view things. We actually have to pay to be scared.
Yeah, exactly. So we actually have to pay to be scared. Like, visceral fear is an integral part of our human psyche. But I mean, how often is that triggered? Like, how often, like, are you, you know, viscerally, like, you know, the adrenaline pump? Like, remember that one time we were in LA and we almost stopped crime?
Oh yeah, we took off after that guy.
You took off after that guy, and remember that visceral kind of response? Like that kind of thing. Or, you know, how often are you afraid for your life? Or and actually, I don't know if you've heard about this. I think it's a culturally, like, a subconscious thing we need to kind of address, because have you heard about these kind of clown sightings?
Yeah,
everywhere?
Yeah. The killer clowns.
Yeah, what's going on with that, man?
I don't know, man. You're like mentioning earlier about the, you know, fear, and like my immediate response is like it.
Oh yeah, yeah. That was your go-to. And I'm like, hey, guess what we're talking about today? And you're like, I'm like, fear. And he's like, oh, it. And that's actually one of the first things that I thought of too when I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about. So let's start with clowns. It was terrifying. That was like early 90s TV movie based on Stephen King's novel, which is also a really good novel, but I mean, it's not a short read by any means. It's like 1,000 pages. Anyway, it starred, it was John Ritter and Tim Curry as Pennywise, yeah, which was just the seminal. They're redoing it.
Are they?
Yeah. I don't think they're going to even touch Tim Curry's performance, though.
No.
We'll see.
There's something about that nostalgic, like, look that they had, like, when the film was made, that played into it just being scarier. I don't think that you could do, like, a HD quality movie and have the same effect. I think there was something about the graininess. I don't know, like, I'm trying to think of other movies, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where the graininess of the movie itself is like part of what causes that kind of fear.
It almost feels kind of like a documentary.
Yeah.
And even back when I was watching it as a kid, I kind of felt like, oh, this really happened.
Yeah, because it looked like it was shot by, like, just a regular camera.
This really happened kind of effect, you know? And that film, one of the scariest things about that film for me, I mean, aside from the fact that, let's talk about clowns for a second here. Yeah. So clowns, I think the scariest thing for me about clowns are, and what Tim Curry did as Pennywise, is that they're supposed to be, first of all, it's a mask, so you don't see the real face of somebody, right? And it is the illusion of innocence, and then you don't know what's going on underneath it.
See, I don't know. I don't know if I don't recall ever having had a bad experience at, like, a circus or something where, like, I got to see a clown, but something about them, even as a kid, was just like, they never seem like, oh, like, you're fun. It's like, no, man, like, you're just creepy. Like, it like, all their features are just so blown out of proportion, and it never really seems like they're all that happy. Even when they're, like, you know, like, smiling at you and they're laughing, it's just like, I don't know, man. It didn't jive.
No.
Like, with what they're trying to portray as to how I was interpreting it.
And honestly, I never saw the appeal of them as a kid. When I was a kindergarten birthday party, my mom got a clown. So my mom made a mistake of inviting the entire class for my kindergarten birthday. So I was her first child and her only child. So the first kindergarten birthday was, you know, my first, you know, time really at school, like a big class. And so she went all out. And so she got a clown, and she had like 40 kids, and this clown when I was a kid, I did not respond well to the clown. And I actually have memories of just not, I mean, I wasn't like vividly terrified, but it made me uncomfortable.
Just uncomfortable, right?
Yeah. Because they don't act like human beings. They act exaggerated. They make weird noises. They,
like I said, I mean, it just seems like everything they do is just grotesquely like outside the realm of like the norm. And even them, their attempt to be jovial and come off as like playful, it's like even that, it's like, nah, man, you're a grown ass adult.
Yeah, exactly. You shouldn't be doing this. And like, the more they act like a clown, the more afraid of that reversal of like, okay, at any moment this guy is just gonna pull out a knife and stab me.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And so, and again, it's like, you know, I think the mask of innocence and the mask of playfulness and joviality, like, it's too extreme to be believable, and I think that makes it tips it onto the opposite side of like, okay, this is actually dangerous.
Now, do you think it's maybe something that maybe in the last 20 or 30 years we've become desensitized by them? Because at some point like circuses were all over the country, right? I mean,
that's true.
There was all sorts of street fairs, there was all sorts of events where clowns were all over the place, and I mean, they had to have had like a golden era where it was part of the culture, where it was like, yeah, like, let's go and have a clown, let's go and see a clown, whereas now it's like, no, like, I'd rather not. Mm-hmm. And now we have these you know, these killer clowns that embody the grotesque nature of clowns that we're talking about to the extreme.
Yeah, well, I mean there was definitely like a golden, like the 20s and 30s, like the circus era, like, you had Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey, like when they were just getting into, you know, the traveling circus was really good. But then they started dying out in the 50s and 60s, the advent of television, like the, you know, people going to live shows and seeing that kind of sideshow type stuff. And immediately, and really, they always were, I mean, people go to the circus, but they were relegated as freaks.
Yeah.
Like, did you ever see that movie, Freaks?
Yep.
Yeah. So even from a very early start, from, the when they were getting their big, you know, breaks as traveling circuses, Ringling Brothers, Barnum Bailey, people wearing masks and exaggerated makeup, I mean, that's like all the way back to the Greeks. That's all the way back to comedy tragedy, right? The mask, the Greek happy face, the made upness, that's all the way back to Greeks. But back then it was like illustrating it with a contrast, like you had, you know, the happy face and the sad face, so there was the negative to play against, whereas with the clown, you know, it's just the straight. You don't have anything like there's no foil for
there's
it.
There's no buffer. There's no.
There's no
reference point as to why they're doing what they're doing. It's just like, I'm just a clown, and it's like, okay.
Well, here, that's a good point, and that reference point I think is what we need, because without that reference point, we just assume it's underneath there. It's like two sides of the same coin, right? And we're only seeing one side, and you're like, okay, well, the other side's got to be there. For example, like the Greek tragedy and comedy, like the dual mask, yeah, right? So you have the happy mask, which is the one they're exaggerating, over-portraying. And we know, subconsciously, we know that there's another side to that, but the clown hides it, and we don't see it. And so I think that's one of the things that, as children, you know, kids kind of pick up on but don't understand. So either they can take that face, that clown face at face value, but like some kids will be deeply unsettled by that.
You know what? Now that I'm thinking about it, I think it's one of the reasons why they're unsettling is that point that you made, where we get to see, like, you know, the one side, which is supposed to be that, like, the happy, like, side, mm-hmm, but underneath we know that there is something else. And I think that the scariest thing for me, or like, I mean, just I think for children in general, is giving them leeway to have their imagination run wild.
It's the scariest.
Where it's like, now you can think of like everything else that's wrong with the situation, and it's like, you know that underneath the surface of what they're trying to portray, there's some sadness or anger, and it's like, well, how sad and how angry are they?
Mm-hmm. It's that famous sentence, like, the scariest things are what you don't see. Like, movies that don't scare me, like slasher movies or, you know, torture porn, like Hostel, yeah, or Saw, where it's just bloody, disgusting stuff. I mean, I can watch that. I'm comedy desensitized, but like, that doesn't scare me because it's shown to me.
Yeah.
What's scary to me is what I don't see. And the clowns, I think, are the epitome of what you don't see, because we know that other side, the other mask is there behind the clown. We just never see it, but we know it's there because we're humans. We know that there's, for every light side to us, there's a dark side. And yeah. So the greater that light side, that comic, that exaggeration is portrayed, the deeper the dark side must go, but they're not showing it to us.
Yeah, I just got scared just right now.
Dun, dun, dun. Do you ever hear of, I mean, this has been all the way through from Greek and Roman, the tragedies and comedies of the Greeks, to the Renaissance playwrights, to the operas of the 16th, 17th century, Pagliacci, the tragic clown. Do you ever hear of that
yep.
one? So they hear that you have that joke. Guy goes, the clown goes to the doctor and he says, I'm really depressed. Do you have anything you can help me out with? And the doctor says, well, you should go check out the circus in town. Go see Pagliacci. He's hilarious. He's like, that'd be great. Except the only thing is I'm Pagliacci.
Yeah.
Yeah. See?
Yeah.
Oh man. So good. So good. And then of course the film, what it did is it of course it gave, you know, literally some teeth to the clown, like, you know, it puts a little bit of horror splash in the clown. One thing about the way that movie was done that really terrified me as a kid is all of it happened in the daytime. Like the yeah. scary scenes is he just appears, not like a jump scare. He just kind of bends out from behind a tree or walks, that one scene where he just kind of walks up from the background into the front, and it's the bright time of day. And it's not like a nighttime horror scene. It's just he's walking up and he's kind of bopping around, comes up in the street and smiles. And he's got those teeth. Terrifying. Terrifying.
I think it was the fact that they threw kids in there too.
Yeah.
Like that, like I think it was like got to me too. But that point that you were making, like it does, like now I'm thinking about it, like probably the scariest moments in the film were like not anything like extraordinary. It was just like him just like showing up and be like, yeah. Hey, I'm here.
Because they do have the scene, you know, spoilers for this old ass movie, but you know, they have the scene in the Chinese restaurant where like they all see the food like come alive, and kind of like there's that scene where they have the fortune cookie that kind of crawl, all the fortune cookies crack yep. open with little creatures in them. I mean, that's scary, but it's not as scary as like just seeing him pop open. And of course they have him turn into the giant spider creature then. That's not but it's the scary, yeah, the scary stuff is like is just him popping up just gently like that. It's terrifying. And so now what do you think, like we have that clown resurgence happening in America, or is that like there's so much, I think some of the negativity or all the negativity and unsettled anxiety, the cultural subconscious, you know, all the uncertainty about, you know, war and terror and the election and, you know, all the things that are going wrong, they kind of surface in these subtle ways. And I think people are reacting. It's like, well, there's so much negative face. We need to put a positive face on. And they put the clown face on, and then they start acting out their aggressions and anxiety.
You know what I was just thinking about, though? Have you ever gone and seen any of the Cirque du Soleil? Because essentially that's what the acrobats are, right? They're all dressed in costume. They're all dressed like clowns. Mm-hmm. But going back to the first point that we were making, where there's a reference point to what they're doing, and there's a linear thought process that they, like a storyline that they're trying to tell you. And I've been to them; they're amazing. And I've never thought about them as a, hey, like you're dressed as a clown and that's creeping me out, or like that's just unsettling. Whereas like if you're just a regular clown, like there isn't any of that background, like, and it's an immediate like gut feeling that you get where you're just like I'm just unsettled by the situation because I don't understand why there's a clown here.
Yeah, exactly. They're out of place. I think the out of placeness kind of like resonates inside you deeply in that scary part.
Do you think it's maybe because we're used to only seeing that during like Halloween? I mean that that people, you know, putting a mask on to hide whoever they are, like in out in the open, or like, you know, in general, and seeing them not in that time of the year is why like they're just so,
that's why it's so unsettling. It's like, yeah. Yeah, it's out of place, out of context. That's another thing that really scares us. Like what was really scary about the It movie is that like the clown was popping up in the daytime. Like it was out of context for a horror movie, because we go into that film thinking, oh, it's going to be scary. Scary stuff happens at night when you're alone, and it's a group of people for both kids and adults, which is even more scary because it's like not only are we empathizing with the kid point of view, but this is happening to adults who are acting like kids because they're reacting to their fearfulness as children. And then we see that happening during the daytime in a completely innocuous environment in a small town, like idyllic town, like in a library, in a restaurant. And yeah. It's like, that's not supposed to happen there. It's supposed to be happening in insane asylums and like, you know, mansions and shit. And it's not happening there. So it's out of context and that throws you too. That makes you scared.
Yes, it does.
So, yeah, the clown like the clown epidemic is kind of spread virally. I think the course the internet and social media have a hand in kind of spreading it out. Why it's more, maybe more, getting more of a trend than it normally would have without, of course, the internet and social media. I think some people are doing it just because that's what it's hip to do right now. I don't know, but if you're going out in clown costumes, people, and you're like hurting people. I mean, just don't go out and hurt people in general, but, I mean, quit that shit. Just quit that shit.
I think that if I was just walking down the street, like the streets of downtown, even if there was, like, you know, massive people out and about, and I saw them, because I've seen some of these pictures of some of these clowns, and there is zero of that, like, joyfulness or that facade of joyfulness. These, they look straight up like, man, like I'm gonna cross the street and not walk near you.
They already look kind of sketchy for sure. But yeah, I think it, of course, the seminal clown horror movie. They also had Killer Clowns. You ever seen the Killer Clowns series?
I did
cheesy
not.
80s film. They did clowns, but they were just, it was more just a straight up like horror movie.
Oh, okay.
And then you know what else has been recent in the recent years is the Purge movies, where the people will go out and they'll be anarchists and they'll dress up and they'll put the masks on.
I just watched that recently. I don't know if I was necessarily scared with in any like real like shape or form, even by those that were wearing the mask. I think it was more of a, yeah, you know, people want to be crazy sometimes, and like being given the opportunity to do so. I think that even the most sensible of us, like, would, in one way or another, partake.
Yeah. Well, and I think the mask and the clown makeup kind of justify or give the person who's doing this permission. It's like, well, it's not me, it's the mask. Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
As somebody who drives for Lyft and has done Halloween the last 2 years, I can tell you that people that wear masks, there's something about them knowing that their actual face isn't being shown that gives them like a leeway to get away with more things or to act out, which is weird because I don't even know them in the first place, but somehow the mask or the look that they have gives them leeway and gives them the permission that they feel they need to be able to like act out.
Yeah. I definitely, and like even when I wear a mask, I mean, I like doing cosplay and dressing up. And even when I notice that, I feel like a freedom a little bit. Like last year for Halloween, I did Phantom of the Opera. I went down to, in San Diego, down to the House of Blues for their Halloween bash. And I felt more audacious and dashing and risky than I usually do. And it's just, I you know, as someone who's reasonably self-aware of my own emotional construct, I definitely notice when I'm wearing masks, I feel a little bit more ballsy and out there for sure. Yeah, clowns, man. Freaking clowns.
Yeah. If you're going to be a clown, all I can say is don't. Cut that shit out. Be Simba from The Lion King.
There you go. A little less threatening. Lion, less threatening than clown. let's see. What else? What about one of the movies that horrified me, I mean, actually, I saw this film with you for the first time. This was back when we were in high school. I don't know if you remember this. The Ring.
Yes.
The first time I saw The Ring was with you. And that was the first film that gave me waking nightmares. And I'm not sure what it was about that film. And I've watched it several times since then. And normally horror films don't really get me unless it's like a jump scare. And that's not like a deep scare. But this really got under my skin. And I think it was the fact that it was something that I use every day, something I'm really comfortable with, the television.
Yes.
And it was reaching out and trying to like kill me. I have a problem with things that like are innocuous that are suddenly made to be horrific and threatening. So I mean the actual like Samara, the little ring girl herself, wasn't that scary to me. The fact that she was crawling out of the TV, the fact that like that one scene where he's watching the thing, the video, which is it was horrific and graphic, but it wasn't really the imagery on there that I mean it was disturbing, but that's not what scared me. It was the fact that she took the fly out of the TV, like the little fly was crawling around, and then it was like in the film or in the TV, and then it was out of the TV.
And I think that for myself it was the same thing. It was as a habitual TV watcher, I think that we all just in general have had that moment where we're like, we wish that we could just reach into whatever the scenario may be. And it's like, man, wouldn't it be nice if we could, like, if there's a depiction of a really nice beach, it's like, wouldn't it be nice if I could just put myself there?
Yeah.
You never think about, like, well, what if stuff were to start coming out of that? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what freaked me out too. It was like, holy shit, like, I'm watching something come out of TV, watching a TV, and now I'm thinking, like, well, what if something comes out of my TV?
Exactly. It was like my and that's the fear reaction. Like suddenly my personal security is threatened. So I think with clowns it's more of like, okay, my idea of identity is threatened, and now with the TV fear, it's that my security is threatened. Another film that really does well with TV fear stuff is, I don't know if you've ever seen it was 1983-84 with James Woods, Videodrome.
Mm-mm.
It's a Cronenberg film. So Cronenberg is kind of one of those master of kind of the special effect, kind of the practical effect horror and a lot of disturbing practical effects. And he did a really good job about in Videodrome. It was a TV station that broadcasts subliminal snuff films and horror stuff underneath what was actually being broadcast, and it would induce a hallucinatory state in people and make them violent. And like the James Woods plays someone who gets onto this, but then is trapped by Videodrome and cannot now tell between reality and what he's hallucinating. And so he becomes the unreliable narrator. And there's an incredibly disturbing scene where he is watching the TV, and the TV, like, he's watching, and it has like sex and violence, and he's watching Videodrome comes on, and there's just like this woman, and it's talking to him about like trying to seduce him, and he walks up to the TV and starts kissing the TV, and then the TV kind of bends and molds and starts kissing him back, and he like sticks his head into the TV, and it's almost like a sexual thing. And then he comes back out, and then they have the snuff film come on, and then like he's thinking about like, oh, wouldn't it be nice to kill somebody, and then he reaches in, and like he's putting his hands, he's like starting touching himself, and it's like this kind of really kind of unhealthy, disturbing cross between sex, violence, and then hallucination, reality. And he sticks his hand in this like slit, like a vaginal slit in his stomach opens up, and then he pulls out a gun, and it's like this flesh gun that's molded to his hand, and it's the most disturbing shit ever. And it's like you don't know if it's real or not, because eventually he goes out and assassinates. He tries to rebel against Videodrome, but by now the subliminal messages have kind of superseded the airways, and there's no rebellion against it. Like everybody's been consumed by Videodrome, and so he goes to try to assassinate the person that's in charge of it, and he has the gun that he pulled out of his chest, but it now it's an actual gun, so you don't know if everything that he's doing is real.
Man, that is... I'll tell you why this is scary. The moment that you don't know or you can't differentiate between like a daydream and reality scares the shit out of me.
Mm-hmm.
Like not being able to tell that difference, not having that very specific line mm-hmm. between those two, like that's scary.
It's terrifying, and that's what the ring did to me, because that gave me my first waking nightmare. So I had that dissociation between like fantasy and reality, like what's in the TV, what's out in real life, right? That dissociation was broken for me. So then I go to sleep that night, and then I wake up and I see the imagery and Samara and stuff in my head, and I wake up and I'm lying in bed and I'm looking up at the ceiling, and then my bedroom mirror, which was across from my bed at the time, and I'm seeing her come out of the TV, but it's superimposed over my actual room. So I'm awake enough to see and register my actual room, but my nightmare is happening over that. And so I try to scream. I can't scream because I'm still sleep paralyzed. I try to move. I can't move. So I'm trapped. And there's just this paralyzing fear. And then gradually my body woke up as I was having the nightmare and she was kind of coming towards me and the dream was happening. And then my vocal cords wake up and I scream myself awake. And then I'm awake, but I still can't move. Like, I'm fully awake, but my body will not respond to me.
That sounds like the epitome of a shitty lucid dream.
It was complete terror. It was one of the first times, only times in my life, where I've experienced complete and utter terror. I peed a little bit. I'm not ashamed to admit that dream made me pee a little bit. And it's exactly that kind of breakdown between reality and fantasy in these two movies that really fuck with me.
Seriously. It's crazy because we actually, and once again, going to like first world problems, man, like us actually paying to have these like mental games being played like on ourselves, because like the movie did its part as soon as it was over, and then you kept the movie going. Mm-hmm. After it was over,
I got my money's worth out of that movie. But again, hashtag first world problems. People that don't have TVs can't have this problem.
No.
So I guess, you know, a lot of the world doesn't, you know, there's still probably a billion people out there without
TVs. You know what I'm thinking about? I'm thinking about like my family down from Mexico. I mean, even the last generation from my mom, you go down to parts of rural Mexico, mm-hmm. and they still have a huge belief in the supernatural and witchcraft and the devil and like all these things that like gets into people's minds, and it basically plays like a loop that they can't like escape from. So imagine like just a bad trip or a bad dream, mm-hmm. that you just can't wake up from. Because like it's just your brain like is just stuck in fear mode, and you're basically just functioning the best you can, always being scared about like the boogeyman coming out of the fucking shadows and getting you.
Yeah.
And it has to be a survival mechanism that we have as a species, right? Mm-hmm. That like keeps us like away from dangerous situations. The problem is when there's no dangerous situations and you start having those feelings out of just film or out of nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And not only with televisions, but like when people started using like cameras, like they thought, like remember, like a lot of people thought like, oh, if they use the camera, it's going to steal your soul.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if you, there's devils coming out of the radio, like the radio was like the devil speaking to you, like these, because it was breaking their barriers of reality. They didn't know. There was no body. There's no voice coming. Like, listen to a radio. There's no body. There's no body telling you. You look at a photograph, and it's like, think about the first time, like, people had a photograph. It's like, holy crap. Like, this is the exact picture of me. Like, what? Like, where am I? Am I being
split? Am I here?
Am I here or am I there? I mean, of course, now we take that perception for granted. But when that first happened, and that's still a break in our reality that's not a natural thing. And then another movie that they kind of did that one step forward was, what was it called? Pulse, where the ghosts were coming out of like cell phones and internet signals too. So they, you know, it kind of these fears kind of move with the technology. But I think because TV is such a ubiquitous and visual medium, that gets the strongest response, at least from me.
I think that besides it, Nightmare on Elm Street,
yeah,
was the second film that I distinctly remember like thinking like, oh man, I fucked up. I should not have watched this. Like, I should have listened to whoever was telling me do not watch this. And it wasn't even so much that it was it wasn't the character of Freddy Krueger. It was the way in which he was getting you, which is your sleep.
Yep.
And it's like it's one of those things where we all like go to sleep, and all we do is what we basically shut down, and then before we know it, we're up again.
Mm-hmm.
And to have a situation where someone steps into that time zone that you're unaware of, and basically messes with you is what God was like, I don't want to go to sleep.
Well, it's taking advantage of a state in which you're completely helpless. Like, you are. That's one of the things that I felt in my waking dream, was like I was paralyzed, not only because there was something scary happening, but I was powerless to stop it. You have no power when you're asleep. Like you're the whim of anybody. Anybody can do anything in your sleep. So yeah, out of all those horror slasher movies of the 1980s, I think that one got me the most too. I mean, it doesn't scare me much anymore, but like that one at the time scared me the most because of exactly that, which you brought up, is like the way in which he got you was like it's a breaking reality. Like you didn't know if you were awake or asleep. And when you were asleep, like that's when you were powerless and you couldn't stop it.
You know what's crazy? All the Freddy Krueger like films that follow that Nightmare on Elm Street did nothing for me. Like even watching them, like I was still like at a young enough age where it it hadn't been that many years since I'd seen Elm Street, but Elm Street was the one that like did it. It was that first introduction to that concept of my dreams being messed with.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that we're like the reason that we're scared about these things is because of the unknown or because we're afraid of dying?
Probably both. Although some people, I think the fear of the, I mean, really are they the kind of the same thing? Because we don't know what happens after we die. Like we're not sure. It's the dying is the ultimate unknown. So I kind of think they're homogenous in a way. I mean,
it has to do something with the subconscious because where I stand now, like there isn't a huge fear of death. It's basically like I've come to understand that it's just part of the process that we call life. It's just we're born, we live, and we die. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason for me to dwell too much on what might or might not happen when I die, seeing as nobody's ever been able to come back and say, hey, this is factually what happens. So yeah, there's no reason for me to worry about it. But that sense of just not knowing, I think, is really what gets me.
I think under the fear, I think a lot of people are afraid of pain associated with death, which is totally understandable. I mean, you just don't want that physiological suffering. But I think the deeper seated issue with death is the unknown after it. But then the same thing, like the way I think about it is like I don't remember what it was like before I was born, and I don't care. And that doesn't scare me. So why should I be scared about what's going to happen after I die? Because it's going to be the same pretty much as when I, you know,
yeah,
before I was born. One of the other films that really kind of scared me and that is also kind of about an unreliable and hallucinatory state is Jacob's Ladder. Have you ever seen Jacob's Ladder? Mm-hmm. It has to do with PTSD. And the guy comes back from war and has hallucinations, but they're extremely disturbing visual hallucinations, like totally submersive audiovisual hallucinations. Very disturbing imagery, a lot of which went into the impetus and development for the game of Silent Hill. All that kind of bloody, fleshy, dismembered, disbodied,
babies coming out the walls.
Psychologically representative horror. And then those two kind of go hand in hand, and that they are both kind of what you didn't see was more important and scarier than what you did in both of these things. Of course, Silent Hill has the fog, so you can't see, and what you do see is straight up freaking terrifying. It defies description. I mean, you've got, you know, these images and these things that don't belong together, these weird body shapes and horrific noises and things. But you know, I remember watching Jacob's Ladder at night alone by yourself is one of the hardest things you can do to yourself. And I think also playing Silent Hill.
We used to do it in the dark. We used to play it in the dark. I would just let you guys handle it, but like I was still extremely scared about like the things that were happening. And I think that anything that like intended to scare you, if they do it correctly, all they give you is basically just like a key to a door, and basically you walk through it, and it's whatever it is that you are most scared of.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's going to be represented like in that like realm of possibilities, because you could be thinking about fucking puppies and kittens and rainbows and shit, but you're not, because you know that that's not within that narrow view scope that they're giving you to like know, like this is not a good place for you to be.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like Silent Hill does a great job with that, because like you're in Silent Hill and then you have these roads that lead nowhere, and there's just like these abysses that drop off. You know what the frick is down there. A lot of the doors don't open. Like, they're just, like, locked. You never get to go in there, and, like, what the fuck is in there? Or they'll drop hints. It's, like, there'll be, like, horrific noises or, like, you know, scratch marks or bloody guts hanging around or whatever. Or, like, these just weird, like, gashed holes and things. And it's just, there's a lot of doors that you kind of walk into and or not. And your choice of what you do and how you react to these kind of, yeah, they give you like a springboard to like a horrific pool and you can jump in or not. I think that's very effective game making as far as the horror genre is concerned. But yeah, it's just like what's not shown is more important than what is. And then what you do see is not only horrific, but suggestive of lots of things that you don't see.
Yeah.
So I mean, like that's the big difference between other horror games like Resident Evil or Dead Space, where it's just like zombies and visceral blood guts and blah, blah, blah. And you just kind of, you know, monsters and you just shoot things up and kill them and they die.
Yeah. In those kind of scenarios, like I'm more of these, like if I was putting myself in that situation, if I was running from zombies, like my scare would be like, I don't want to get caught by the zombies. I don't want to be a zombie. Whereas some of the like Silent Hill is like, it's like there's nothing really, really chasing you. There's just a lot of weird shit that's happening around you.
Yeah.
And like you can't have that mental breakdown at some point. Like if I was in that situation where I'd be like, you know what, man, like this sucks. Like I don't think like I can make it any longer, like having my psyche just be like being pushed to the extreme. Like I can run till, you know, I can't run anymore, and then that's the end of that. But your psyche is completely different, and it the worst part is when it lingers. Mm-hmm. When you've turned off the console and you're just kind of hanging out, and like all of a sudden you're just looking at things a little bit like more intensely, and like you're like, I know nothing's gonna come out of there, but I have a feeling like it might.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, yeah, and that feeling of might, that possibility, that's what's the terrifying thing, because it's something you can't nail down, because the brain hates uncertainty, right?
Yeah.
Like you want things nailed down. Like we were just talking about earlier, like, you know, we should get things nailed down in our life and, you know, get, you know, solid, you know, careers and all that stuff and just nail everything down. It's that uncertainty that kills you. Like the brain hates it. We want locked patterns. We want reassurance. We want security. And then the best ones are the ones that take that away from
your
us.
Your brain's like, he's like, shit, I don't know, man. Anything's possible.
Oh, man. Did you see on Netflix that Stranger Things show?
Yeah, I did.
That was scary.
It was scary.
Because that was a lot. Again, they did a really good job of, I mean, not only in like the 80s nostalgia cheese factor of and production of like recalling like Stand By Me and Poltergeist and things like that, but one of the scariest things about the show was that the upside down world, they didn't show too much of it. And that thing that was hunting them around, they didn't show too much of it until the very end. And even at the very end, you weren't sure what the hell was going on.
Yeah. And you know what, like distinctly, like what caught me was the scene where the little girl like touches it. It's like the thing was completely unaware that we were here. And the only reason that it knew that we were there at that point is because we were the ones that fucked up and made the initial contact.
Yeah.
And it's like I don't want to make contact with anything anymore. Mm-hmm. If there's ETs out there, I don't want them to know we're out here.
Exactly. Like, should we be reaching out? Like, chances are, I mean, they're not going to be, you know, what are the chances they have the same, you know, moral and ethical, you know, standards that most human beings do.
But that's, yeah, I mean, I would say that's what got me. I think it was the aware of the unknown and then the introduction of us, like, of us opening that door.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the scarier part of the whole series was like, look, man, we were perfectly fine, like, you know, like wrecking our own lives. And now we have something that had no idea that we were here, that we were here. And now we've gone ahead and basically opened the door for something to come into our concept of reality.
Yep. And it's when we're not going to know, we're not going to understand it. Like that's what's one of the things too, is that concept fused with the concept of not being able to understand motivations of whatever it is coming through. H.P. Lovecraft, Call of Cthulhu, the Cthulhu mythos. That's what that's all about. It's like human beings searching and reaching for shit they should not be messing with, and then opening doors they can't close, and then having creatures and beings and intelligences whose motivations we can never comprehend and will never comprehend try to destroy us. That's terrifying. That's freaking terrifying. And again, it's that uncertainty. It's like, I think what we're nailing down here is like the primal fear thing for any human being is not knowing, is uncertainty. Yeah. But whether it be an identity issue, a security issue, unsecure about technology or about understanding motivations of others, an empathy issue.
I think that if you're giving the direction to go into and then that concept of uncertainty being applied to it, because you can, like, uncertainty is something that we all deal on a daily basis. And then, mm-hmm. I mean, from the moment that you wake up to the moment that you go to sleep, like, you have no idea of what that day holds for you.
Yeah.
And we still go through it. And like, many of us like get up and we're happy, go lucky, like jolly, like we're optimistic of what the possibility is. But I think if it's framed in a situation where like, look, there's bad shit happening, and now you can imagine whatever you want, like, that's where your brain is automatically going to start going. Because, like, well, what else should I be worried about? What else should I be concerned about that's going to try to get me?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just being able to, you know, take life as it is, which is basically just a giant uncertainty and you just trying to make the best of it.
And people can't get a piece of that. You know, I just realized, though, the best clown ever, the Joker, said when he was played by Heath Ledger in Dark Knight, he's like, you know the thing about chaos? It's fear. He says this. And a clown just succinctly bottom lined everything we've been talking about.
You just
about.
Tied this whole thing together in a beautiful bow.
Okay. Chaos is fear. What is chaos but uncertainty, right?
Yeah.
Chaos is the definition of uncertainty, right? Things are not ordered. Things are in disorder that we can't predict. And what is a thing about fear, chaos? It's fear. And who said it? A fucking clown. A fucking clown. There was talking to a guy with two faces.
Yeah.
Holy shit. What did I just do? If I could afford to drop this mic, I would.
This was an unseen turn of events. That was amazing.
Holy shit. I can't believe I just did that.
Talking in circles.
Bringing it around together.
Damn.
A couple of shows that I wanted to kind of bring up. Did you ever watch Twilight Zone?
Yeah.
So like Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, like the old ones, that was kind of like the public consciousness, like first foray into like weekly visitations. Like Rod Sterling was really trying to probe about people's unknowns, fears, stuff like that, and using the media of TV to like reach in and make people uncomfortable each week.
I think I really, really enjoy the Twilight Zone. And I can honestly tell you that I've never seen an episode, even at a younger age, where I was like, oh man, like this is scary. And I think part of that has to do with the way that as a society, we've moved along in the last like 40 or 50 years, where the things that people were fearful of and the knowledge that was available at the time, that Twilight Zone was scary. Where like you could watch it now and it's just like it's some of it is almost comical, where it's just like the information that they might have been missing when those were being made we have now, and it's like no, now we can make sense of it and mm-hmm. we understand that there's no reason for us to be afraid of it.
Yeah and I mean but to them back then it was the unknown, so exactly. We can see, you know, how one of the great thing about science is it makes the unknown knowable. So you know, I think in a lot of ways, science is the remedy of fear. Like science rationalizes out our fears, and we can progress. But of course, the more science we have, the more questions we ask, the more we have. So maybe it's science is in a way the remedy of fear, but also the cause of it, because it just opens up more doors to newer and unknowable shit. Right?
Yes.
But yeah, Twilight Zone, like. I mean, there's still some back then, like the of course William Shatner on the plane with the wing, thing on the wing. Of course, you know. I mean, that still like gets me sometimes. Just
really?
Like, well, cause, you know why? Because no one believes him. It's like thing is like, is it his reality or is it everybody else? Is like, which reality is real? It's like, is he seeing that for real or is he hallucinating?
How would you react to a situation where you saw something that like? A group of people around you didn't. Like, would your rational brain come to the conclusion of like, oh, like, I must be hallucinating and I should seek some help? Or would it be like, holy shit, there's something that's like, doesn't like, you know, like that, I don't know how to describe it.
There's something that's nobody else has seen.
Something that's so wrong that nobody sees, and like, I'm concerned for everybody else, including myself.
Yeah, like that's tough.
Where like, at what point does the rational part of your brain go into work? And it's like,
I think I would seek to disprove my own belief until if I couldn't disprove it, then I would start trying to convince people. So I would give myself enough time to kind of evaluate the situation. Be like, okay, well, let me make sure I'm right, because nobody's seeing this like first off really, really well. So maybe I'm wrong. My first thing is to assume I'm wrong. So then I will try to correct that. And if I can't correct it, I'm like, okay, well, I must be right. Like everything I'm feeling in my gut, and my gut and my observation and my tests and my hypotheses have been proved correct. I need to try. And then if I keep trying and nobody believes me, then you start going insane. That's when I start losing it. But that's the thing about that episode is, like, in the end of that episode, we, the viewer, the Twilight Zone airplane episode, we, the viewer, see the damage that little flying nymph or imp has done to the plane. But the thing is, like, so he's on the plane. He sees the dude doing the damage to the wing, and nobody else does. And then the plane lands, and he gets taken away, and nobody... Now, is that damage really there? Are we seeing what he's seeing? Or are we hallucinating along with him that damage is there? Or is that damage not really there, and we and him are both crazy? See, that's what really gets me about that episode.
It goes back to the questioning of your construct of reality, and what might be real to you might not be real to somebody else. And then at what point, like, do all of our consciousness like meld into a fabric of reality? And what happens when little tears start popping up?
Yeah. Twilight Zone is really good at that. Like, remember the one where that chick's face is wrapped up and all the doctor's faces are in shadow?
Yeah, they're all pig faces.
And they're all pig faces and she's gorgeous. But the whole episode, we don't know what anybody looks like. And so, like, the whole thing is just like, I don't know. And then it turns our expectations of what's what on our heads. And that was really good, too. Of course, that's a classic, you know, that's classic, and it's kind of probably been overdone in a lot of situations. But back then, that was, like, original. That was, like, no one did that before. That was really cool. Another one where uncertainty comes into play a lot of times, and is X-Files. X-Files wasn't a really, like... wasn't like a overtly like supposed to be super scary show, but it was always very unsettling to me.
Yeah.
And it was because the whole thing was about the unknown. It's like, what are people hiding? What are people covering up? What don't we know? And of course, some episodes had like the visceral kind of alien, disgusting, you know, special effects and everything like that. But a lot of them were ones where it's just like, well, you know, we went through all this trouble and we don't know any more than we did before.
Yeah.
That was a good one. I hear they're bringing that back. They did like a short run of it last year, but I think they're going to renew it for a whole bunch more time.
Netflix, right?
No, it was on Fox. It was on a short run on Fox. But I don't think Netflix is gonna do this, a series of. I think Fox still owns the rights, and they're going to keep going with it. So,
no, well, I mean, they still got. Netflix still has Stranger Things. Mm-hmm. They're going to do the second season too.
Mm-hmm.
Dealing more, I think anything having to deal with little kids is always scary. Anything having to do with little kids is always just like, and I think a lot of it is because kids are supposed to be the representation of good,
mm-hmm.
and you know, like not having anything, not having to do anything with anything like bad.
Yeah,
but like when you have something like Ringu, where it's like, you know, the main thing coming at you as a kid, it's like, oh, shit, all right, like evil kids.
Yeah, you expect them. It's kind of similar to clown thing. It's like you expect a certain behavior and innocence out of them, and then they're not that way. They're lying to you. It's a mask. It's a guise. Same thing with The Exorcist.
Damn, next little kid I see, I'm going to punch right in the face.
I know, right? The Exorcist gets a lot of people. A lot of times The Exorcist gets people because it's a religious thing, but that's not what gets me about it. It's the fact that, you know, that she was innocent, and then she's like, we know she's not supposed to be that conduit evil, but she is. But I think the Ringu scares me a little bit more, because we see her in The Exorcist. We see her as a good, innocent child beforehand, whereas in The Ring, we never see Samara being, you know, skipping in her little pigtails, doing jump ropes and shit.
And it turns out that the girl's like has always been evil.
She's always been fucked up anyway. So it never there never really was a good side to her, but we didn't know that. So no.
See?
Yeah. Oh, did you ever see the movie Orphan?
No.
So this movie gets me in a very subtle way, and it's a girl that she is an orphan, and she gets adopted by a family, and she keeps trying to seduce the dad, and she's like 12 or 13. Not like a child, but young. And maybe even a little younger, maybe like 11 or 12. I can't remember. But young, and they make her look younger in the film. And you know it's wrong. You feel creepy just watching it. And the thing is that she has some sort of genetic disorder where she doesn't age. So she's actually like way older. She's actually like 50 or 60 or something like that.
Oh, shit.
But she's in the body of this little girl. And so she has this thing where she goes from family to family, and all the families eventually, like, somebody dies in a mysterious circumstance. So she's like a serial killer that, like, is going, you know, from family to family, like, killing people. And so she's seducing this husband, and she actually falls in love with this husband, and she's trying to, like, get rid of the family so they can be together, and, like, slowly trying to, like, convince him. And so, you know, all this behavior, all this stuff, and you know that she's unbalanced, but it's behind the face of an innocent child, but it's actually like a woman, like old woman who is evil, or not evil but bad.
Yeah,
that's terrifying.
Oh man, that is scary. That is real scary.
It's pretty bad. It's kind of scary. I suggest you check it out. It's called Orphan.
There's like two or three that you've mentioned that I really want to go and check out now.
Yeah. Orphan is it came out in like mid-2000s, I think. I think it's Kiefer Sutherland. Pretty good film. One of the games that I was thinking about that really kind of set me kind of unbalanced is when it's an environment where it's kind of an unknown environment. So like FPSs don't really get me that much, like first person shooters, like, you know, Call of Duty or things like that or whatever. But you know what kind of gets me sometimes is when I'm playing games where the immersive elements of the game are such that I forget where I am. Like, I'll get to a case point. The Metroid Prime series, the first-person Metroid games, like, they put you in an alien world, and the ambiance and special effects and kind of setting of that game is such that, like, when I'm playing it alone in the dark and you have your headphones on, like, and some of the games do this too. Soma did it, which is like a underwater base kind of. It's kind of disturbing that way. And it's not jump scares. I'm not talking about jump scares or things popping at you like aliens popping down. It's the ambiance, the setting, the environment that really does it for me. The music, the little sound effects, things like that. If a game like Silent Hill is good at showing you what wasn't there, and what was shown was like hinting. A game, an FPS especially, where you're like in the position, so you're assuming more of a role, where what they do show, the focus on what they do show, is such that you forget your place. You forget where you are. When I'm not in my room, when I'm actually there, like I feel like I'm there.
You ever been at a hotel or camping or somewhere that's not like, you know, the normal places where you sleep, and then you wake up and it takes you like a minute and a half before you can orient yourself again. And you're like, cause you wake up and like nothing that you see is what you're used to seeing. Mm-hmm. And it takes your brain a minute to figure out like, oh, like what is this? Where am I? Like, and then it takes it a minute before it realizes like, oh, well, this is what happened last night. This is how I ended up here. I can see that. I mean,
So games that can elicit that space, that moment, that little interval when you can't really discern where you are. Good FPSs do that, especially ones that are good horror FPSs. But even non-horror FPSs, like Metro Prime is a horror FPS, but there are moments when I'm in these alien environments where I kind of lose kind of sight of where I am, or like the game Soma, which I already mentioned. Both great games, you haven't played them, but But again, yeah, it's that uncertainty. It's like, where am I? So instead of like identity or technology or you know, not knowing the motivations of somebody else, it's location.
Yeah.
So again, it's just like different different symptoms, same cause.
I remember being a kid and going out camping and being scared, yeah. Being awake with nobody else being awake, and then you like. You know, you hear those sounds, and it's like, even though it's just a cricket or something like that, it's like it elicits that same kind of like, I don't know this place. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's lurking around the corner.
Yep.
Yeah, I could see that being, I can see that's why like we immerse ourselves so much in films and video games. I think maybe, I mean, I know that most of us probably don't go out as much as we used to some of these super isolated remote areas,
yeah,
where we could just scare ourselves.
Well, so much the world is known now, like, you know, we have Google Maps, so we are never lost, you know, we're always in contact. There are all the spaces where things are unknown to us, be it identity, be it technology, be it location, they're disappearing. So maybe that's why we seek out more and more to be in that space, because there's a part of us that maybe sickly or weirdly or conversely kind of needs that visceral response at some points. And it may not be everybody. Like, some people just don't like being, you know, don't like horror movies or like horror games or whatever. But I think for a lot of people, in some way, you're seeking out, even though you're afraid of it, you're seeking out some sort of uncertainty, because it keeps your reality in perspective.
That holds true. I think that makes a lot of sense.
All right. Well, I think, you know, we got pretty far today on fear.
You know what? You made a lot of good points that like I'd never like really. You've connected a lot of dots that I'd never saw as being tied together, and then tying it into Heath Ledger with Batman.
I think that sums like, up pretty just, succinctly.
Like,
you
just kicked me in the nuts. I was like, holy shit!
And you gave a lot of good examples, a lot of good points too. And now I freaking want to go watch a horror movie. Let's go.
Yeah.
Let's go watch a homie play some salad here or something. So if you want to talk to us about your insights or experiences with scary games, scary movies, scary TV shows, scary life experiences, feel free to drop us a line on our website, www.nerdfunnel.com, facebook.com/nerdfunnel, like our page, join the conversation, or watch and like our videos on YouTube at youtube.com/nerdfunnel, or hit us up on Twitter at nerdfunnel, and just keep in contact, keep in touch. It's one of our favorite times of the year, scary time of the year, Halloween, so go out and enjoy, and until next time, you've been nerdfunneled.
Yeah.